Welcome to the Making Sense Podcast. This is Sam Harris. Today I'm speaking with Rahm Emanuel. Rahm is currently the U.S. Ambassador to Japan, where he is just wrapping up his term. He was also the 55th mayor of the city of Chicago, a position he held until 2019. Before that, he was President Obama's chief of staff. He was also a member of the U.S. House of Representatives from Illinois. And prior to that, you might remember him as a key member of President Clinton's administration, ultimately serving as his senior advisor for policy and politics. I happened to be going to Japan and realized I could talk to Rahm in person at the embassy, and there was a lot to talk about. We generally discuss the state of the world and American politics. We talk about his ambassadorship in Japan, the mystery of Japan's economic health, U.S. competition with China, possible conflict over Taiwan and the Philippines, the significance of the South China Sea, the history of the U.S.-Japan friendship. And then we turn to U.S. politics. We discuss how the Democratic Party lost its way, immigration, whether Vice President Harris needs a sister soldier moment, whether she should explain her changes of position better than she has. And then after we cover that fraught territory, we turn to the happy topic of the Middle East. We discuss the standing of Israel in the eyes of the world, anti-Semitism, the Abraham Accords, Hamas, settlements in the West Bank, the influence of the religious right in Israel, a possible war with Iran, Netanyahu and Israeli security, a two-state solution, whether a Harris administration would reliably support Israel, and other topics. Anyway, the conversation was a lot of fun, and now I bring you Ambassador Rahm Emanuel. So I'm here with Ambassador Rahm Emanuel. Ambassador, thanks for joining me.
Oh, thanks for coming in on your vacation.
Yeah, welcome.
It's kind of like a work release program.
Exactly, yeah.
How are you?
We'll see if I can get through complete sentences here, because I've been in the country for almost 48 hours.
Oh, so you woke up at 1 in the morning?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Close.
Yeah. Yeah, I know that feeling.
After 4 hours sleep.
Yeah.
But it's great to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
We were thrown together by the incomparable Michael Kivas.
Correct.
And so we owe him the credit of this.
Well, we'll see at the end of the show whether he gets points or demerits.
Exactly. So there's so much to talk about. I mean, I want to start with your current post here in Japan, mm-hmm. but we're going to wander from the Pacific.
We're going to play Risk. Fire. We're going to go across the map.
Yeah, we're going to, because obviously you've touched, you have so many areas of expertise. So just to remind people, you have served in two presidential administrations.
Counting this would be three, yeah. President Clinton, senior advisor, President Obama's chief of staff, and then ambassador for President Biden, or for the United States. So you could say.
Forgive me, I didn't really think of an ambassadorship as, is it technically?
That's fair. No, you're right.
Is it in the executive branch? Or?
No, it's State Department. You could say, but you're appointed. You know, there's two types of appointments I don't want to waste on it. There's a career appointment, and then there's political appointments. We're the only country that really has it. And in the political sphere, it breaks down donors or formerly elected officials, like Senator Mansfield, majority leader, ambassador here, former Vice President Walter Mondale, ambassador here. Former Speaker of the House, Tom Foley, ambassador here.
This has to be a coveted gig, right? On the list of countries where you can be an ambassador,
you haven't seen the House, but this probably will get me in trouble, but it will never be referred to as Section 8 public housing. But if you're going to live in public housing, that's the way to go.
Yeah.
But the job is actually, on a serious note, but the job itself at this moment in time between the United States and Japan, is like everything every other ambassador wanted. Japan's ready to break out, do things from a real energy and time, et cetera. And I think they've surprised themselves, I could, about how much they've gotten done in a short period of time. Mm-hmm. We're in the middle of redesigning our entire Indo-Pacific strategy from a hub and spoke to this lattice work. Because of my background and experience, I've been intimately involved in the trilateral with Korea, Japan, and the United States, pushing that along. And then also the one with the United States, Japan, and Philippines. And so, it has been from a work product, from kind of that intellectual energy that comes from really kind of putting your thumb on the scale, totally fascinating. From a quality of life, it's a culture and experience that I feel like it's a gift to be part of something I never really knew.
Yeah.
And then on a personal level, there's things about the society I find Now, again, we're outside of it. For a lot of people, sometimes inside, they feel it's oppressive. So you could feel that about our society on certain things. But, you know, as a former mayor that a city of Chicago that created safe passage routes for kids to walk to school, my staff always tired of hearing
I'd
that.
Say they accomplished that in Tokyo, from what I can tell.
You have 8 5-year-olds walk this nine blocks to school, just put their hand up, cars come to a stop. The respect for life, I mean, you then realize how much we have stolen children's childhood from them in America. Mm. So from a lot of levels, I find this to be professionally rewarding and personally a gift. And I told the president that. Mm. I want to thank him for giving me the opportunity to experience a whole new culture.
All right. So there are two mysteries that confront the novice in Japan.
Well, but neither one of us would refer to ourselves as novice.
That's my first time here. I'm fresh off the plane. From what I can tell, there has been an impressive amount of economic stagnation here in almost a lost generation. I mean, at least if you're looking at the stock market index, you look at I think if you had put a dollar in the Nikkei in 1989, you'd have exactly a dollar today or something close to that.
Depends what the yen's trades that moment, but yes.
Complete this thought because it's not as invidious as it sounds. And yet it's obviously an incredibly prosperous society, right? It's just impeccable on so many levels, and it's not showing, at least from what I can tell, the signs of economic dysfunction that you would expect if you just looked at that graph. So what can you?
Yeah, one of the things I've read a little, and I'm very persuaded, I don't think the analysis, the lost decades, is really, it's a top line. So if you lift the hood, if you go to the manufacturing side of the economy, from a productivity measurement, et cetera, it's incredibly productive. Why? Japan got a head start on the decline in population, so they're leaders in robotics and automation. The top four robotic companies in the world, two of them are Japanese. Mm. Of the top seven, depending on how you want to count it, or eight automation companies, almost half are Japanese. So from the manufacturing side, which is a bigger piece of their economy than for the United States, quite productive and stayed at world-class standards. Now, on the service side, your description is accurate. The cloud is just coming here as a kind of a metaphor for a bigger kind of stagnation in the service side and technology adoption, et cetera. But the economy is a very export-oriented and it's a highly world-class economy. They have a lot of strengths, in my view. I mean, you have a highly educated workforce.
Yeah.
They stay to the office till 10, 11 o'clock at night. We can't get people in America at 10 or 11 in the morning into the office. Great universities, highly safe and secure, modern infrastructure system. You can get anywhere in the Indo-Pacific daily, multiple times. So there's a lot of advantages and one of to that part of the economy. And in the areas, I'll give you take semiconductors, space, it gets a lot of notoriety. I could refer to Japan as the supply chain of the supply chain. So there's about 18 companies that are dominant in the materials and packaging, which is so essential, that have anywhere from 40 to 70% of worldwide share of market in their space. Mm. And when you think of the people that make machines for the semiconductor, there's ASML in the Netherlands, Tokyo Electron here. And so they have a lot that is a specialty, but you could get overwhelmed and biased from the writing, and I'm not sure it's 100% accurate. And then it skews the way you interpret stuff. And it's in kind of early stage velocity now back.
There's a much higher debt than we're carrying in the U.S., right? Isn't it?
Much higher than anybody else. I mean, there's 200%+. On the other hand, you know, they do have that we don't have $22 trillion, not yet, in savings. Hmm. So while their debt is extremely high from a GDP standpoint, their savings is off the chart. Now, that's the good news. The bad news, it's earning, up until this point, zero interest rate, and it's sitting, as our grandparents would do, in the mattress.
Yeah.
There was no 401k, no savings type of, no allocation of capital. I sound like I was listening to Larry Summers when I was at the White House, but the use of capital is not the most efficient.
So from your perch here, how are you viewing our growing competition with China?
That's an open-ended question.
Increasingly bellicose noises coming from the other side of the Pacific?
You know, here's what I would, I think we have to have a more, not, I wouldn't say a nuanced view, but, and this is one of the things I've enjoyed working on in the sense of the trilats and some of the stuff. China made a major mistake in this region. Go back 10 years with Wolf Warrior and maritime or other type of aggression to every country. You saw it just the other day with the Vietnam on their fishing. You see it in the Philippines. You see it on the border with India. You see it strafing Australian planes. You see what they've done to Japan in the just got last couple of weeks in the sense of territorial, both aerial, naval, surface ship. It wouldn't call it aggression, but kind of violation. That has made our job of organizing much easier. They try to isolate a country like the Philippines like they're doing now. And it, we have been able to, through our lattice work system that President Biden has put really put together, to take China as a strategy of isolating a country and make it the isolated party. And so on a political side and a security side, I think we're in a better position than we were before. And I think China, which is why they always complain, they're being contained or we're trying to contain them. They do a pretty good job of containing themselves because everybody in the region right now is trying to figure out how to make sure that the United States is anchored here as a counterweight against China. That's a big advantage for us. Where I think we are a beat behind the music, I think we're doing a great job, if I may say, on the diplomatic side, a really good job in updating on our security alliances and bringing, like, what given what Japan's doing, the ROK is doing, India's doing, others, a lot. I think China is making the same mistakes with their economic coercion, their mercantilism, their debt trap diplomacy. And we are just in the early stages of responding to that in the way that it took us about 4 years ago to figure out how to use their tactics against them, their own tactics against them. And China is, and I would say this, we made a mistake as a country, all of us, we're all responsible for it. We called them a strategic competitor, believed what we were saying. China, when Xi comes in, decides the United States is a strategic adversary on their back heels because of the financial and banking and problems. And we held on to this concept they were a competitor. They adopted a policy that we were an adversary, and we just caught on to who they are and what they're doing. And so we lost a decade. That said, they also are in the beginning stages of losing a decade, but we have to make the most of that time and move with due speed and smart, not just urgency.
What do you think, we're going to get to U.S. politics, but what do you think the implications are of the U.S. election for our future with China?
Well, it depends, first of all, what happens in the election. The gap in your question is that branch point.
Well, here's what I think. Down each of those paths, what is China? I'm kind of biased, but
let me say this. This is a crude way to say it. The Indo-Pacific is an away game for us. It's a home game for China. And if you think you're going to be relevant in dealing with China, either on the security angle, the political angle, the diplomatic angle, the economic angle, you need allies and you need allies to trust you. And so if you are not good with your allies, then you got a problem here because you can't do anything in the region without a Japan, without a Republic of Korea, without an Australia, without a New Zealand, without a Singapore, without an India, without the Philippines. So I got to be careful that so I don't get outside the Hatch Act of U.S. being partisan. I think it's pretty clear one candidate's really strong about alliances and allies, believes in them. It's very pertinent to this part of the world. You cannot operate that way without allies. And if you don't give allies trust and confidence, they'll do the bare minimum. And let me try, if I could, illustrate one point. You know, for 30 or 40 years, presidents have tried to bring China, or rather Japan and Korea, on the same page with us. And for a lot of historical reasons, we all have a complicated history with Japan. Japan has a complicated history with Korea. We actually also have a complicated history with Korea. That said, given where they were, given where their countries were, given their trust in the United States and specifically trust with the administration, both President Yoon and Prime Minister Kishida went beyond just clearing the bar. They went farther. And the end result was probably one of the bigger, bolder moves we made in the region diplomatically the last 20, 30 years. China notices that. Now, if you don't work with your allies and give them confidence, they're not going to take the step. Look, take a look at President Marcos right now. Unlike Duarte, he is taking a step of trust with the United States. You don't treat an ally with that kind of respect. They something that's really, really important to the United States can slip through our fingers. So I think our election, and again, I got to be careful.
Yeah, remind me of the implications of that Hatch Act. Just how tongue-tied will you be?
Well, I become a roommate for you. The cost of it is I lose a job and then I become your roommate. Okay. And that's really kind of not good for you. No, you can't violate. And there's some attorney at the State Department's like, I don't know, ghosting me everywhere on this thing. So I'm not allowed to be partisan. So I will analyze.
So if you ask me about what it means here,
you have to really believe in alliances if you want to be a counterweight to China. If you don't, and you want to basically say, well, they're a bit, you know, where might equals right, and that's China's right, and that's their backyard, that's a different stake. I think you will find our allies taking a different strategy to the United States after that.
Let me say this.
The Hatch Act applies to U.S. politics. Sometimes people don't think it applies to, I'm joking, my involvement in Japan.
Right. So, what about Taiwan? Is this something perhaps you can't comment on it with full transparency? But I mean, what do you understand our policy with respect to Taiwan
It's a very clear ambiguity.
So it's a strategic ambiguity is our official policy.
It's established when Kissinger and Nixon came up with the sense of the one China policy. But, you know, there's three flashpoints right now. The South China Sea with Philippines. There's the Taiwan Straits and Taiwan. And then there's the 38th parallel with North Korea and South Korea. And so not wrong to ask about Taiwan, but everything you're thinking about Taiwan is playing out, not just Taiwan, but in real time, something's playing out right now in the South China Sea with the Philippines and China. You have a sovereign nation, Philippines. The International Court in 2016, China versus Philippines ruled in favor of the Philippines. China has summarily dismissed it, not even listened to it. And they are a treaty ally of the United States. So while a lot of people, you know, rush right to Taiwan, my view is, I don't know why you're passing up what's going on with the Philippines, because this is everything we're talking about. And whether the islands, the fishing rights, et cetera, and the international court rules established by the court, interpreted by the court, matters in whether a small country has standing against a more powerful country.
Is it your understanding that we have the same policy with respect to the Philippines as Taiwan?
No, in fact, we have a stronger policy because they're a treaty ally. Taiwan is not a treaty ally.
Are we treaty bound to come to their defense?
Yeah. I mean, if something was to happen, and Senate President Marcos has indicated this and said something, that he would consider this as something that would happen to the Philippines from a security standpoint or their military could trigger that alliance and that commitment in the word of the United States. Now, I try to remind people, the South China Sea that, you know, Vietnam, Philippines, Malaysia, all kind of counter, other countries too, 14% of the world's entire fish stock and catch is in that water. Massive amount of undiscovered oil and natural gas reserves there. China is in confrontation. Just the other day, there was a story. Their Coast Guard, they went after the Vietnamese fishing boats, said that those are their islands, and it's very clear they're Vietnamese islands. They're doing it with the Philippines, et cetera. Now, we don't have a treaty ally with, Vietnam's not a treaty ally. Philippines is a treaty ally.
Right.
We have a commitment to their not only their sovereignty, but their military safety.
Is that multilateral? Does the UK have the same commitment with the Philippines? Or
No.
Us?
Yes, okay. Us. Yeah, based on history.
So you mentioned the complicated history between Japan and the US and Japan and Korea, et cetera. Mm-hmm. That's actually the second mystery I wanted to ask you about. So for anyone who even has a passing understanding of what happened during World War II in the Pacific, it seems frankly miraculous that we found in Japan a friend of such durable goodwill as has persisted for the last 60 some odd years. I don't know when the friendship started, if you can place it on the calendar, but it had to be at the latest 1960 or so, right? I mean, when did things completely thaw?
Well, I do think it's a testament how the bitterest of foes can become the best of friends.
Yeah, I mean, it offers some hope for the world, one would hope, but it does seem, so frankly, miraculous when you try to map it onto other conflicts that we're going to talk about.
when I listen to the Japanese, when they have a change, there is, and you read history, this is my reading of it, so other people say he doesn't know what he's talking about. There's no doubt, and it's over in our the residence for the ambassador is where General MacArthur receives the emperor. Now, our big moment at the end of the war, end, is the signing on the Missouri. That's our that's our moment. That's our kind of trigger point. The meeting with the emperor and the acceptance of the emperor will stay as the emperor is a trigger point for the Japanese, as my, as I read history, as I witness others talk about it. And the way the emperor then talks about the United States. And that is the first step on a journey to a different place from enemies during war to building friends. The second piece is, I think it's really, really, nobody ever told me about this. And maybe I'm guilty of not talking to the right people or whatever. I think I talked to a lot of people when I was what I call in the Senate COVID quarantine before you get confirmed. So we all know George Kennan's long memo about the Soviet Union, containment, et cetera. Marshall sends Kennan here afterward. I mean, this is later in his career, early in the late 40s. And he writes an equally valuable memo about the role Japan will play as an anchor in this post-49 to communist China and an anchor for the United States in the Pacific, Indo-Pacific. It wasn't called Indo then, but the Pacific or in Southeast Asia. And it's, I happen to see it just once referenced in a book, so I pulled it up. It's unbelievably prescient. Now, so you can date 62 and the military alliance, et cetera, but I would literally, if you ask me, okay, what was the first step on that journey to a different place? The receiving the emperor, us embracing the role of the emperor, which allowed Japan to move on. It's pretty also clear in the days of both Hiroshima and Nagasaki, if we were more explicit where Secretary of State Burns is not, that we would, which is what Stimson was arguing for, that the emperor would stay. The war may have ended sooner. The judgment, it's a judgment call, it's an interpretation. So that to me is, and it would give you hope. And I'll tell you the other thing, and I say this about the President Biden when he held the ROK and the Japanese Prime Minister and the ROK President in Camp David. It's pretty ugly in Ukraine, pretty ugly in the Middle East. A lot of conflict in the world, Sudan, and you look at the rest of the certain battles in Africa. There was a place in Camp David where it shows what diplomacy and dialogue can achieve versus, I'm not saying that sometimes conflicts don't have their own logic, but I thought that was a hopeful sign in a pretty dark time that we're living in.
Yeah. I mean, as I say, it would be wonderful if there were a deep analogy between what we accomplished here, given just how horrific World War II was and the current crises you've mentioned. Now we're going to get to the Middle East and Iran because I
because you can't help yourself.
Certainly top of mind. But we're going to go through let's go through US politics and see what the Hatch Act can allow us to talk about. I mean, so you obviously
a former ballet dancer. I'm pretty flexible.
Yeah, okay, we'll see. You have a deep knowledge of Democratic politics, obviously, and also you were a mayor of Chicago, which gave you a special view of the local implications of certain policies. Many of us, so I'm a lifelong Democrat. I've never voted Republican. I don't think I've been tempted to vote Republican, but I have often thought in the last few years, certainly since what appeared to be a kind of social justice moral panic that took over the Democratic Party in around 2020, that I would campaign for Liz Cheney or Mitt Romney at this point. Just give me a normal Republican, and I could get behind that person. And if you know my history and castigating the theocrats on the Republican side, you would know just how far a pendulum swing that is. But that it's in response to a sense that the Democratic Party has really lost its way. It may be recovering its way. Certainly, it seems to be executing a kind of pivot, however unacknowledged in the campaign of Vice President Harris at the moment. But we're talking about a party which seemed for years at a stretch, again, I would date this to the 2020 campaign, to be, I mean, pick your ghastly policy, defund the police. People should have their reputations destroyed for doubting whether there are more than two sexes biologically. I mean, it's just, there was an activist takeover of the conversation that I think has done great harm to our politics, if for no other reason than it has given real motive force to the personality cult that has subsumed the Republican Party. And there are many single issue voters now feel free to respond.
Which of the 42 questions do you want me to address?
I'll sharpen it up. Respond to the claim that the Democrats lost their minds for a few years there on issues like immigration and crime. So, and what is politically necessary now in the final stages of this campaign?
Okay. So, well, that's this campaign, but it's that question is about a bigger than just this election.
Yeah.
Okay, so let me try to unpack a couple things that there's a lot in there. Not one that ever believed in or supported defund the police. And even when those who advocated said, well, it doesn't mean what it says, well, then my attitude was, well, no, don't say it. Because if it doesn't mean what it says, you're confusing a lot of people. But you have to back up as a mayor that also had to work with and should have worked with the management of the police department. We had a lot of Chicago, New York, LA, every city of any size had safeguards in. The truth is they atrophied, and the police departments needed to be better managed from the responsibilities they had to both serve and protect. It's just a fact. And as a mayor, you're accountable for that. But the police department's oversights, while you had checks in the system, they really weren't working, and we had a confidence in them when they weren't working. But when you put into the mosaic of what you're talking about, not just on the policing side, I don't think the Democratic Party could endorse today, or I think it could now, but in the period of time you were talking about, what Senator Kennedy and Senator John McCain had negotiated. And that was only 10 years ago from an immigration policy. Mm. President Clinton had advocated, which is my kind of North Star about this, that we're both a country of immigrants and a country of laws, and both have to be respected. I actually think the American people are more welcoming about immigrants, but they don't like their laws being broken, and they don't like a sense of out of control or somebody cheating a system into something else. So they're actually, when you look at communities around the country, actually quite receptive to immigrants. It's a sense that the law is not being abided by.
Yeah.
And we went as, I don't want to say we, there were loud voices. Now, those voices didn't mean that they were loud. It doesn't mean they represented a lot of people. So, as I have a rule in politics, sound is not always fury. Don't ever confuse sound with fury. Sometimes sound is fury, but sometimes it's just sound. So they were loud voices. But the fact is, those voices did not, like people that would talk about Latinx or et cetera, weren't representing where the country was or even where the communities are. And give you one example. We haven't had an election yet. I think, as a son and a grandson of an immigrant, I can say this, not the ambassador, but as a son and a grandson of an immigrant, and I consider myself a child of an immigrant father, obviously President Trump's rhetoric about immigrants is really harsh and ugly. Yet, he's doing better among Hispanics than almost anybody since George Bush 43. So that tells you the voices that thought they were representing the immigrant community didn't really know where the immigrant community, quote unquote, was. And it's pretty clear that even in the Hispanic community, there's not a respect for just crossing the border and being as an undocumented, or if you want to use the term illegal or not use illegal, use undocumented. Pretty clear there's a respect also for the law and for the law being followed. Mm-hmm. And I thought our party and voices in our party, rather, were too much about a permissive culture and not much about a value-based culture. And that has caught up with us, straight up. Mm. And if you look at working class, because it's not just white, that's 2016 Trump. You look at 2024 Trump, it's not working class whites, it's working class. That there's an economic piece to this, but it's much more cultural. And our party, when you look at the success of Roosevelt, you look at the success of Kennedy, you look at the success of Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, and not to draw the others out, or you could also put Jimmy Carter in there. It was the whole package, not just the economics, but also the sense of a value system. Remember, the most famous line, or one of the most famous lines for Bill Clinton, his 92 acceptance speech at the convention in New York was to the families and the parents that work hard, play by the rules, pay the taxes, raise their kids to know right from wrong. I'm going to be your president. That is a value statement.
Yeah.
That is not, he had his middle class tax cut, et cetera. But in the same sense that when President Obama appealed to a sense of hope, and that there is no blue or red America. There are only Americans of many different stripes and colors. There was a value there. And I think our party loses its way when it doesn't actually understand the cultural component. I believe firmly people are more and vote more than the totality of their wallet. Their wallet's a big piece. The safety of their kids is a big piece. The neighborhood school is a big piece. The things that happen in their community is a big piece. And we diminish that. And it's ironic because the times we have succeeded and created, not just in one election, but a lasting legacy, is when we respect the what are termed cultural and societal issues. And we hurt ourselves when we veer off of that.
So do you think the pendulum is swinging back?
Yes.
And
very quickly, you can see it in not only manifested in elections, you can see it very quickly also within the party. Yeah.
So the question is,
and I don't know if you think though, I'm cutting you off. I apologize, but you are talking to an Emmanuel. That's a habit of ours. I don't think that those voices ever really represented the Democratic Party. They intimidated a lot of people in the Democratic Party. Try to shut them down.
Well, but by numbers, they didn't. The only research I know of on this point suggests that it was 8% of activists or 8% of the party, but they captured the institutions, right? It became the new orthodoxy.
Well, what they
captured the New York Times, they captured Harvard, they captured
you're saying captured, I say they silenced a lot of other, intimidated a lot of other folks. Either way, they have done, but they didn't that's why I always say about politics, sound is not always fury. They did not represent, they never even got close to a majority. They never even got close to 10%.
But just a sanity check here. I believe this is true. I as the words tumble out of my mouth, I can't believe they're real, but this is, I have this fact checked at least by CNN.
What?
That when asked, I believe by the ACLU at some point in 2020, Vice President Harris said that she was in favor of offering gender reassignment surgery at taxpayer expense to incarcerated illegal immigrants, right? She checked that box. Call it whatever you want. That most of America perceives that as just sheer lunacy, if not morally abhorrent. And that's riding atop of, just take this one issue, and I realize this is plutonium that I've brought into your embassy.
Don't worry, I have police for that.
Yeah. It's you have some number of people left of center in our country, and they certainly seem to be a majority from the point of view of the New York Times and the establishment, where that you would begin to castigate anyone who would use the term woman in a context that could seem to be.
Look, I'm not going to sit here and not say I'm not.
Something happened. You're admitting that something happened.
Oh, no. Yes. There's something. Rationality got snapped for a second. I also happen to think it snapped back. But that said, and I'm not saying that either whether it's the New York Times or other institutions lost their center of gravity and their balance. I don't disagree with you. But I also think that you can't. Well, look, you said you've only voted Democrat. I grew up in a home of. My grandfather was a socialist, became a Democrat because of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. I mean, I think a Democrat was one of the 10 lost tribes for the Jewish people. Mm-hmm. So that's what I grew up in. I'm not, I will never vote for a Republican. Can't vote, but now I just crossed the Hatch Act. So, okay, there goes that.
The police are on their way.
Yeah, but here's what I do want to say is, we're spending time because, and legitimately, care from a center/progressive set of politics because it matters. Mm-hmm. But you actually, if you would ask me what is amiss, and I got to watch myself here, and I'm not doing a good job self-policing, as a second ago showed, what has happened over the last 20 years, the last 10, 15 years in the Republican Party, and the voices there, for all you want to say about the some things in the Democratic Party, I think it's important to remember there's the Democratic Party center has held. I'm not saying that we've had bad moments of where the shrill has silenced people or intimidated people, or the claim for orthodoxy hasn't. On the other hand, you said you would vote for Liz Cheney and Mitt Romney. They have no home.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
still have a home in the Democratic Party. I still have a home in the Democratic Party. And that's a difference where they don't. Jeff Flake, who's a good friend, we served together in Congress, who was ambassador to Turkey. He just endorsed again, second time around. He endorsed President Biden last time, this time Kamala Harris, because there isn't a home. That's just not true in the Democratic Party. So it's a very different. And again, yep. I got to be careful. I probably twice have gone off sides and the ref is going to call to blow the whistle and give me a yellow flag here.
But again, I find your optimism here.
I'm a hardened Paul.
If the pendulum has swung back,
I think it's
swinging back. So just take this narrow case that I just gave you. Does Vice President Harris, candidate Harris, need to acknowledge the change of opinion, it's going unremarked. I mean, she's acting like someone who never thought this.
Okay,
should she say, "Listen, our party went a little crazy in 2020, right? And I got caught up in this, right? Now, put your political hat on if you can, and acknowledge she's trailing three or four things of that sort that have a kind of, you know, you can't unring this crazy bell that rang in 2020, and that was one of them. There's one with I don't think defund the police can be hung around her neck, but
hang that around her neck when you look at her record as both a district attorney and attorney general. No way you could do that, and it's not an accident that while she coming out of the box as the candidate for president, she leaned on that voice and that experience.
But she has something around not making it a crime to come to the country illegally, right? There's a reboot in her brain, clearly, around issues of immigration, if not crime, socially polarizing issues like the transgender debate. So I'll just give you the perception from the center and the center right is she's carefully avoiding any conversation that would provoke questions on these kinds of topics. And she's just hoping to get into the end zone in November without ever having to address this change of heart. I worry that, and again, I worry as someone who desperately wants to see her be the next president, I worry that there's enough of the country who thinks she is a stealth candidate who will implement all of these crazy woke policies if she only gets the chance, because she hasn't acknowledged just how clearly the spell has broken for her.
Well, no.
But so, let me ask you, I'll give you one more way to sharpen it up. Shouldn't she have a sister soldier moment of some kind on these issues politically?
Yeah, but see, that's not what you were earlier asking.
I
want to be clear. You were saying she has to deal with herself and say something about where Kamala Harris.
But she would have. So if she had a sister soldier moment on one of these topics, someone's going to say, "Well, wait a minute. You said in 2020 X. Y." She's going to have the conversation.
Let me make a general rule. Let me just give you a general assessment without making it about Kamala Harris.
Okay.
Two rules I've had about presidential politics and campaigns: to be a contender that wins, you have to project strength, confidence, and optimism, and in a public mind's eye, they got to see you as being able to fill the space of that office. That's essential. More importantly for the president than for a senator or a congressman, a little less for a governor, and then a little less for mayor. But if you're a chief executive, and I may be biased because I'm from Chicago, you can't be smaller than the office. That's a big office, and they want a big person for it. If you go back through presidential history, at least in take World War II forward, the candidate that has projected the strength, the confidence, and the optimism has won. Whether it's, you're using shorthand, I happen to know what you mean by a sister soldier moment, but be able to be seen as strong enough to stand up and call a friend wrong when they're wrong is what you're looking at as a tactic to achieve that kind of larger purpose. That may or may not be right. Again, I'm sitting 8,000 miles away, 14 hours away. But I do know what you have to, what in 2008 and in 1992, at least those are my experiences, Bill Clinton and Barack Obama's first election, they, in a comparative basis against both Bush 41, John McCain, they won that fight, strength, confidence, and optimism, and big enough, ready enough for the office.
Well, remind me, I don't know if it had political implications, but did President Obama ever explain his change of heart around gay marriage? Did he ever have the interview?
Now, remember, he's president then, not presidential candidate.
Right. So,
and he did.
For a second term, did it come up?
His biggest thing in 08 was his change of heart and running for president. He had explained that he changed his view. And I think, you know, you've got to, as a one of the things, look, I mean, you and I are doing this interview. I think 36 hours after the debate, I thought one of the better moments was when, I mean, I call him Tim. The vice presidential candidate, Tim Walz, I'm happy to recruit him. You know, when he said, hey, that was a knucklehead move. He just handled it. And people can relate to him and relate to that. He just said, it's a knucklehead move. And that was it. And you got to be, you know, when you've done something wrong, you say it. You're saying change your heart and say, look, with more information, I got it. Your questions, if I may, you're doing the podcast, so you can ask whatever you want, is so much where she has to come clean about something. And my view is that's not what I would do.
Well, my fear
and
is
again, that, I got to be careful here.
Yeah, no, my fear is that
can
half
we play
the country
this on November 2nd. Yeah. at 3 a.m. Right,
But to take a peculiar example, but nonetheless an influential one.
We're spending a lot of time here. I'm kind of wishing we'd go to the Middle East real quick.
Something
Let's
cheerful.
Go to something easy.
Easy and cheerful. But you take a peculiar person like Elon Musk, right? Yeah. Who's a blowhard to rival all blowhards at this moment. But he has a megaphone that 200 million people are listening to. Honestly, he's a single issue voter on this kind of topic, right? I mean, like he got radicalized on some of these culture war issues.
Yeah.
And he is treating her like a stealth, far left Democratic activist, right? And he's effectively doing that to an audience of some tens of millions of people who, if they're not persuadable, they're not persuadable. But what I'm imagining is that there are some, whoever the undecided voters are out there.
Here's what you're saying, and if I may, which is, I think, a challenge for the party and not just for her. We've allowed a few shrill voices in our party to become a caricature of our party. And they are first shrill, B, they don't represent anything but themselves, and C, we've allowed them, because we haven't used our own voice, to become a caricature as if that's our opinion.
So if those sentences came out of her mouth, what would be wrong with that? If you were running the campaign.
I'm not running the campaign. I've got to be really clear. But to me,
those are the perfect sentences. I want them coming out of her mouth.
I know
mouth.
What you want, but I keep trying to steer you. All it's right. not about her saying what I understand what you're saying. And for my money, and again, I'm at a distance, it's being able, you said sister soldier. What I think is, look, you got to be able to, when one of your own friends or fellow travelers is wrong, call them out. And when you disagree, have the confidence, whether that's her or any candidate. Now, yours, the sister soldier moment, having been part of the 92 campaign for President Clinton, it was even his end welfare as we know it, or putting 100,000 cops, or his immigration policy, or a nation of laws and a nation of immigrants. And again, that was my birth in national politics, which is he understood, given where he grew up in Arkansas and in a single mother home, a value system that he never had a distance with, which is actually was a political kryptonite because he had a connectivity. Last Democrat to win working class white people. And it was on economics, but it was also because he understood where people lived and how they lived their lives. We say that, and then sometimes as a party, we don't act that way. And in this example, whether you want to pick defund the police or other type of shorthands that explain like the term Latinx, et cetera, that we allow voices to become character, which is not where we are. And I think part of a candidate for an executive office has to be clear of their sense, but also where the country is. And when you look at what voters are left, that's an important thing to do. It's also important because, you know, what was the joke in politics? You should be authentic. And if you can't do that, fake it. So.
All right. Well, that's going to have to stand
as close as I'm going to get.
She'll take that download if she wants it. All right. On to happier ground.
Yeah, yeah.
Middle East. First, what's your impression of the reason that Israel is so obviously held to a double standard by the world community? I mean, is anti-Semitism the explanation, or is it anti-colonialism
that gets some weird topspin?
Take the UN, the more resolutions against Israel than name your rogues gallery of other countries that are clearly guilty of human rights abuses and even genocides. Sudan, North Korea. I mean, it's insane. How did we get here?
Well, let me try to unwind that if I can. Yeah. One is, I landed in Israel 2 days after the 67 war ended with my mother and my two brothers. Went there every summer, 67, 68, 69, 70, 71, 72, 73. So, and Israel projected itself, going back to those days, appropriately, as a different army, a moral army that was both an effective defense force, but also one that lived by a certain code that was higher. So it asked for that judgment, and it should. Mm. And it has had days in which it has achieved that. I don't think, and achieved that, and there's days it's fallen short of that, of its own standard. But I always remind people, you know, in the situation they have on Gaza and the situation they have on the north, you know, you have a country that uses missiles to protect its people fighting a force that uses people to protect its missiles. Mm-hmm. It's very different. And then you treat them morally equal. Second, you had two perpetrators, one clearly raped and mutilated women and children, and another where the case may have been, and they were honored. And the other one where there may have been in prisons, it looks like there was, sexual abuse and rape, and they've been arrested and are going to be held by a criminal. So they're not morally equal, but you treat them morally equal. And I'm sorry.
I'm asking why that way. Because the double standard is so shocking and galling. No,
but there is, Israel asked for a standard, and I'm glad they did. Mm-hmm. And we should hold them to a higher standard because they want it, and I want them to be that higher standard. And when they're honest to it, they're a better country, et cetera. Now, I want to be clear on my three things I want to be clear. One is I'm a hawk on security and I'm a dove on peace. Second is my troubles with the current government, specifically the prime minister, goes way back to 2009 when I was chief of staff for President Obama. So, and I also believe, and I just want to get this out on the floor here, is there's been three tactics Israel's used over the last 40 years. One, a negotiated Egypt, Jordan, Abraham Accords brought Israel security, integration into the region, and peace. They have done unilateral, which is with Hamas and Lebanon and in Gaza, and it's been a disaster. They have tried divorce with the West Bank, and it's been a failure. Whether you like it or not, negotiated is the only one that has worked for Israel's long-term strategic benefit, which is why key voices of the IDF are for it. Why the international community does it, there is anti-Semitism behind it. Mm-hmm. Why do they try to do hundreds of resolutions against Israel? Because it's cheap, it's easy, and it's a way to clean somebody's conscience. They don't do it. They never did it in the way, in the caliber with what Syria has done to their own citizens. But Israel is a democracy, and Syria will never be a democracy. And Israel should be held to a high standard as they held themselves to. Their own system does, their own armed forces leadership do. And I'm happy they do it.
Yeah.
Okay. Does the rest of the world try to hold a double standard or hold Israel because it's motivated by, you know, somehow Israel's an occupying force or took over in a colonial way the way neither Australia, Canada, or the United States government or others did? Give me a break. But Israel's only picked out, yes, there's anti-Semitism. 100% is the driving motor. Is it 100%? Explain everybody's position? No. Are there anti-Semites in the world? Yes. And they use their anti-Semitism dressed up as anti-Zionism to manifest their views. And Israel is a target of that.
Yeah,
there's no doubt, but it's not everybody who... I have my own problems. You know, if you were to ask me, you haven't, so I'll answer the question that you haven't asked me. Yeah. Look, I think the IDF is doing incredible things for Israel now, but it is creating an opening that they have to take advantage of from a political standpoint. And that is a step they've never done yet.
But if negotiation is the answer, who could they possibly negotiate with at this point?
Well, you can go through, well, first of all.
But certainly not Hamas, Hezbollah, or the Republic of Iran.
No, but there's a lot of history around what happened on the Gaza side. And it's been out in the press, so you and I can both talk about it. Yeah. I mean, the Israeli security establishment was upset that their own government raised new issues when they could have gotten the hostage out. I find, now, to that case, fair point. I do, as I say to a lot of people that say, oh, we're for a ceasefire. Well, I'm for a ceasefire. I'm for the one that was on October 6th. You had 20,000 Palestinians working, people in Gaza working in Israel, more people in Gaza working in Israel than any other country in the Middle East. I'm for a ceasefire. Now, there have been 5 ceasefires since 2006, of which all of them have been violated by Hamas. So I'm a little cynical when they say they want a permanent ceasefire. What does permanent mean? You won't rape women again? Mm. Well, that one I'm for. When you ask for permanent, tell me what permanent is. Does permanent mean you will not rape women and children? You will not kill children in front of their parents? You won't kill parents in front of children? For that ceasefire, okay, I'm in. But will you sign on to that? What does permanent mean? That you will never again violate and kill an Israeli citizen just because they're a citizen at a peace rally, at a peace music concert? Is that part of permanent? So to me, I'm in. Let's go. Sign it. Mm. I'm ready. We're going to spell out what permanent looks like. No raping anymore. No mutilating children. No cutting fetuses out of women. That's permanent for me. I'm game.
Yeah. Okay. So now we're on the hawkish side of defense.
I'm also on a hawkish side. No, that's on the, I'm a hawkish. I'm also
but
hawkish about security. The security for Israel does come with negotiated. And here's the piece. You could finally get members of the Abraham Corps to be part of the security, which is, in my view, that is a big opportunity for Israel. The founding dream of Ben-Gurion and my dad's generation was to be accepted into the region as a country in that region. And there are many members of the Gulf community that were willing to participate in helping that happen. Now, Hamas, you have to have two parties to dance. Different times, Hamas was ready to dance. Israel wasn't, etc. Israel was.
But Hamas was always committed to the destruction of Israel.
Still is.
Yeah. So it's not, it's any ceasefire
Let
with
me say
Hamas
this, which is
not
why,
peace.
Which is why it's, I find it ironic that in only a little notice of this in the major papers and in the United States and media, Hamas is really unpopular in Gaza. And the war that they conducted is really unpopular now. Started popular. It's plummeted now, and Hamas has plummeted now, and it's gotten some recognition. But let me say this, if you were an elected official with those type of numbers, you'd be all over the news.
Yeah, although it's popular in the West Bank, and
they haven't experienced what October 7th brought, like Gaza.
Yeah, but I think we should be slow to read too much into that loss of sympathy, given because
it has
pragmatic reasons, but it doesn't have ideological reasons. What we need in the region is for jihadism itself to be unpopular. The martyrology.
Well, how about this?
The 4-year-olds in UN funded schools.
We need that, but between now and that happening, I got a lot of other things we got to do.
If I'm waiting for that, then
forget about it.
Okay, but if that can't get accomplished, if you're always going to have a death cult on your southern border and a death cult on your northern border, and you've just negotiated a ceasefire with them, you always have this existential problem if you're Israel.
No. So
what are you picturing the solution to look like if you still have children being raised
Gaza and Lebanon were unilateral steps by Israel. And that created a vacuum for Hezbollah and Hamas.
So just to unpack that, the unilateral withdrawal.
And, you know, as the late Yitzhak Rabin said, I'm going to negotiate peace as if there's no terror, and I'm going to fight terrorism as if there's no peace. Mm. But he understood you had to walk both sides of the street on that. And so to me, you've accomplished certain things of a deterrence in Gaza. Now you have to find the venue to solidify it, and because you created space for politics and diplomacy to take over. Is there a jihad? Is there a treating of the committed to the destruction of the state of Israel? Yeah, which is why, to me, given that Hamas is ready to give up governance and share it with the PLO, ready to have members of the Gulf nations in on the security and the creating a buffer between Israel and Gaza, is a real opportunity that should not be lost. Mm. And I think for a set of new conditions, that opportunity window was lost. And I think that's a real disadvantage. I'm not waiting for the end of jihad. I'm waiting for the promise. And I do believe, having traveled through the West Bank, having traveled another time, different era through Gaza, but at least on the West Bank, I think there's a possibility to give an alternative. And I know that's not popular in Israel, but I will say this, the path they're on, as it relates to the West Bank, is unsustainable. It's unsustainable for them, and it's unsustainable for the state of Israel and for the dreams that, and not just dreams, the aspiration of the creating of the state of Israel for what it has always been, its North Star.
So you're talking about the settlements and the and the empowering of the religious right and the kind of the messianism.
I think the, you know, again, the religious, I'm doing broad strokes. I want to be careful because I'm stereotyping. But though there's elements within this government today that are driving Israel to, look, let me back up. There's elements in the Israeli government that are driving Israel into an international and political ghetto.
Do you want to name names?
You don't need me to name
Ben-Gavir, names. Ben-Gavir, Smotrich. Yeah.
And I will just say, you know, our whole lives, going back 500 years, but it's clearly in the middle of the 20th century, was never to go back into a ghetto. And I would find it the irony of history that it would be voices in the state of Israel that would lead Israel back into a ghetto. Mm.
Well, what's wrong with this hypothesis that what Israel's enemies understand or will understand at the end of the day is strength, and the path to stability in the region moves through the unequivocal surrender of forces like Hamas and Hezbollah, and ultimately the regime of theocrats controlling Iran.
You know, right? Again, I'm dealing.
So we're talking about wars a war that actually has to be won as opposed to negotiated away. Do you have an intuition that that's just wrong and bloody awful,
I'm a product of my experiences. Mm-hmm.
I know I sound that I'm to the right of. I said I'm a Democrat, but I sound like I'm to the right of John Bolton on this issue.
I didn't know you could be to the right. Anybody could be to the right of Bolton. So let me say it. I would say one of the most beautiful moments in my public career that I've witnessed for me was accompanying in 1994 President Clinton to the Gulf of Aqaba and the signing of the peace treaty between Jordan and Israel. Now, I'm dealing with two states, not a state and a non-state actor. Yeah. Very different. And the Israeli Armed Forces leadership stood at attention, saluting as a Jordanian national anthem was played. And the Jordanian, would be the Joint Chiefs, their equivalent, stood at attention as Hatikva was played. Mm. And then both King Hussein and Yitzhak Rabin and their respective foreign minister with President Clinton in the center signed a peace treaty ending the war between and the hostilities between not only Israel and Jordan, but a peace treaty. Again, two state actors, not a state actor and a terrorist organization. That to me was one of the most beautiful, one of the most sublime, one of the most eloquent moments, because I thought here were two militaries that had fought and had a respect for the other country, stood at attention, their armed forces at the other country's national anthem. Now, strength is important everywhere, but it's very important in that region. It does elicit respect in this way that recent events, what Israel has done in to Hezbollah, will get it respect. But strength in and of itself as an end and as rather than a means is where you confuse means and ends. I'm for strength. I'm for a credible deterrence. I am not for it to be my ends. I understand it as a means. The ends is the end of hostility and the ability to move on in a world where hostility is not the way you think of your world now or operate under. Israel's had hostility and threat this whole time. Strength is important. The ability to execute that strength, the ability to have your deterrence and the credibility of your deterrence perceived by your enemies. But it's only a means. And because of the 67, because of what Israel could have done in 73, that is how you ended up in 1979 with Camp David Accords. It was that strength that gave you the window. And then both President Carter, Begin, and Sadat had political courage. But in and of itself, the strength wouldn't have gotten you there. The almost losing the Third Army in the deserts of the Sinai is what made Sadat realize, you know what? We're going to end this.
Okay, one more question about strength. How did we lose our deterrence so fully with Iran? I would say Israel and the United States.
I can't believe you're sitting here on a 5 o'clock on a Thursday in Tokyo time mm-hmm. telling me we have to turn. Iran is thinking of everything they could do not to be in our line of sight.
So you think what deterrence looks like. I don't want to see what deterrence looks like.
Iran uses its third parties because it's fearful of a head-on. No.
But it's also now lobbying missiles directly into Israel.
They did before. And the last thing they want is a full-on onslaught of a battle.
Do you think the United States has made any mistakes with respect to Iran? Like roll forward from President Obama to the present. What do you think about our policy with Iran? I wish we were on video right now.
Can somebody give me a full glass of water so I can throw it right about now? Okay.
the hatch act's not going to cover this.
No. What, me throwing water at you? No, it will cover that.
Your answer, yeah.
Look, I'm almost interested in going back to American politics for a second. So I think that I don't agree with your assessment, which is why Iran acts subterfuge and through third parties, because they actually don't want mano to mano.
But there's no deniability. I mean, we know they're
then that's a different thing of what we should do to that. That's a different thing. That is not the same thing as what you're saying. They actually, the credibility there's, and what they just recently done in Israel, given everything that Israel had done, both in Tehran, Damascus, Beirut, and South Lebanon. I'm not so sure if the shoes were on the other foot. So that said, the aircraft carriers, the 500 plus Tomahawks, the 100 plus both F-35s, F-22s, F-16, F-15s, that has a deterrent effect. Which is why they've never gone straight out in the United States and have basically said that was a response to everything you've done and we're done. But I think people in Iran are sitting there and they said we've had now, let's see, 100, so close to 200 plus ICBMs fired at Israel and not one have done any serious damage.
Yeah.
In fact, the terrorist on the light rail in Israel has had more of an effect on Israel than any one of your missiles, drones, or cruise missiles. I think there's a real question inside the armed forces of the Iranians about what they got.
What are you expecting to happen in the next months?
Well, I that's not for me. Look, I'm not in the rooms with everybody, et cetera, but I think that, you and I are sitting here, Bibi Netanyahu has just announced that they're going to do something. So I don't know. I don't know what they're going to do, and I don't know how Iran's going to read it. So I think you got to prepare for all scenarios.
You were pretty critical of Netanyahu without going into detail. Do you think at this moment, a different prime minister would be behaving differently? I mean, has the actual policy militarily been affected in this current context, or is this just, this would play out this way with anyone in charge?
Well, I want to be careful, but I think it's very clear that it's a hypothetical and I'm answering a hypothetical, which I shouldn't, but I know one thing. The security forces of Israel were pretty public about their view of kind of take a ceasefire deal and get the hostages out. And I think a different prime minister would have been would have acted different. But I don't know. You tell me who and I can tell you.
Do you think, I mean, that just, again, this is, it's almost irresponsible to have such a strong opinion on this point, being so far away from it, but it just seems like that's kicking the can down the road, that the problem of Hezbollah is unchanged. The problem of Hamas is unchanged. You get some more hostages out. That's wonderful, but it's.
I don't agree with you.
Really? You think? But you think there's some future negotiating partner in Hezbollah and Hamas, or you think?
I think you're first of all putting words. I never said that.
No,
I
mean, you didn't say that. Implied by what you just said.
No, it doesn't. Yeah. What I think is this: I think that Hamas is well aware that they've lost the people of Gaza, and I think they know it, and I think they want out of anything accountable to that, which is why they're willing to share power. They spent 20 years fighting the PLO because they don't want the PLO in the Gaza. And now they're saying, please come here. So I think they know they got real problems. Do I think they're going to turn around and say, you know what, on second thought, we're okay with the state of Israel? No.
Right. So
I don't, but that's not Israel's job is to be able to move on, allow their country to be prosper, to have a future in the country, so people are not leaving Israel, but they see a future in Israel. And that's not happening right now. That's what I care about.
So if we came back in 20 years and Israel had solved its existential concerns and there was peace in the region, what do you think that looks like? Are you imagining a successful two-state solution? Are you imagining a one-state solution that actually makes sense?
Here's what I would say. As I get back to my core principle, Israel's tried three different tactics. One unilateral, it gave it Hezbollah and Hamas. One divorce, which has given it Jenin and other problems in the West Bank. And Israel's been in my, and I understand you negotiate peace and you get bombs blowing up on Dizengoff Square and Circle. Mm-hmm. But you once had a partner. And I see a future where, given what Israel has with Jordan, Egypt, and the Abraham Accords and building it, fulfilling what has been a dream since 48, to be an accepted country in the region, and a future where people of Israel and the children of Israel and the grandchildren of Israel can live normal lives, and the children and grandchildren of Nablus, Jericho, can also live normal lives. And I think Israel's security is having a state on the other side. I think that would be actually a state actor would be treated in the international community different than a non-state actor, given where dynamics are. You don't do it for that reason, but you have a real state that has responsibility for its own aspirations.
Right. All right, final question.
Yes.
This is for our mutual friend, Dan Senor. I recently heard him say on his own podcast, or maybe it was on the commentary podcast, that he thought, all things considered, Trump was a better bet. If you're a single issue voter, and your issue was Israel and America's unqualified defense of an ally, you would vote for Trump, all things considered. Within the bounds of the Hatch Act, why should Jews feel like they can vote for Harris and know that America is going to remain a staunch ally of Israel? Because I get the sense, there's no polling behind this, but I get the sense that there are many Jews after October 7th, who have become single issue voters in America,
I'm not going to say about it. Let me say something on behalf of both the tradition Kamala Harris comes from, both out of Biden, Clinton, and Obama. I remember people said, oh, President Obama doesn't feel state of Israel in his kishkas. Well, you wouldn't have an Iron Dome if it wasn't for President Obama. And I know that firsthand. Okay? All the things that Israel's pointing to today, that every American Jew that's proud of the security apparatus that Israel's used against both Hezbollah and Iran, I know who signed the check and I know who signed off on it. Otherwise, it was just a great concept. When it comes to the security state of Israel, the tradition that Kamala Harris comes from, that she's committed to, and I've heard her verbalize both publicly and privately, I have no doubts about. And second of all, I'm sorry. I happen to think a two-state solution is in Israel's interest, okay? It is, and I believe in it. I believe what President Biden has advocated, and there's a reason. I not only believe it, major voices, both from the Israel security apparatus that are there today and graduated out of the Israel security, retired, believe in that too, because what the path is on is unsustainable. This idea that just force, might is right. I happen to think advocating for a two-state solution, I advocate for two-state, and I'm for Israel, okay? I'm for it because it's in Israel's self-interest. And guess what? Many four-star generals who've lost sons and daughters in the armed forces who are come out of Israel's security are for exactly what I'm for. There's a reason one of the most revered generals in Israel's history, Yitzhak Rabin, Ehud Barak, are for exactly what I advocated. Do you consider them single-issue voters? I do. I think they think a lot about Israel's security. So I think an American Jew sitting in the comfort of the mezzanine, sitting there, somehow if Israel says X and agreeing with them makes you supportive of Israel, I don't agree with that.
Ambassador Emanuel, thank you for your time.
Thank you, because given all the answers I gave your questions, it's formerly Ambassador Rahm Emanuel.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah.
Great to meet you.
Great to meet you. Thank you.